Since taking office, President Obama has repeatedly stated his intention to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. While the prison population there has shrunk, the number of detainees held at Bagram Prison in Afghanistan has grown dramatically. That prison and the people held there is the focus of a new report issued by the group Human Rights First, and we are joined now by its author, Daphne Aviador, a senior associate at the organization. Welcome to today's Backstory segment.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Have I pronounced your last name correctly? I'm always afraid.
It's Aviatar, but close.
Okay, it'll be Aviatar from now on.
Okay.
You report that there are currently 1,700 prisoners held at Bagram. Isn't that nearly 10 times the number held at Guantanamo?
It is, and actually, in my last meeting with the Detainee Affairs Office in the Pentagon, they said that the number has gone up to 2,000. So there's now at least 2,000 prisoners being held at the Bagram Air Base.
And who are they?
US soldiers. We don't know. I mean, that's one of the big issues, is the United States does not release information on who these prisoners are. So we know much less about them than we know about the people who are held at Guantanamo. Because at Guantanamo, at this point, there's 171 prisoners left at this point. Most of them have lawyers. They have the right to go to court and challenge their detention. So we know much more about who they are. With Bagram, none of those rights apply. So we know almost nothing about who these people are.
Is that the reason the number has gone up so dramatically since President Obama was elected? He promised to close down Guantanamo, so these are the people who might have gone to Guantanamo otherwise?
Well, it's funny. I mean, to some extent, yes. Once the decision was made that Guantanamo should close, the administration stopped sending, and even under the Bush administration, they stopped sending people there. Once the Supreme Court decided that they had the right to go to court to challenge their detention, that was the end of transferring people to Guantanamo. So then the Bagram prison started to grow. And under President Bush, there were up to 650 detainees there by the time he left office. But now there's almost more than triple that number under President Obama. And really the reason is because with the surge of troops that President Obama led, the United States was much more aggressive about rounding up Afghans, doing night raids on Afghan homes, and gathering men and interrogating them and bringing them into the prison. And so these are supposedly the ones that the U.S. military thinks are dangerous, but there have been a lot of questions raised about whether these are really the dangerous people, whether they've got the right people, whether the intelligence that their information is based on is correct. So that's one of the big problems, is whether these are even the right people who need to be detained.
Since March 2009, the Obama administration has claimed the authority to detain unprivileged enemy belligerents. That's the same thing as what we used to call unlawful enemy combatants when the Bush administration was in the White House.
Basically,
is there any difference?
I think there's one word difference now. Instead of just people who supported the Taliban or al-Qaeda, it has to be substantially supported. So they added one word, but other than that, it's basically the same thing.
And are most of these detainees Afghan, or are we seeing a lot of foreign nationals?
There are some foreign nationals. Mostly they're Afghan. There are some Pakistanis who are picked up on the Afghan side of the border. At least that's what the U.S. military says. Again, since certain Supreme Court decisions, the military says it has not brought people from other countries to Bagram, which it used to do earlier on during the early years of the Bush administration, because the concern is that the court would then grant them the right to challenge that detention in court. So what they're doing now, or what they're saying they're doing now, is detaining people only that are arrested within Afghanistan.
What kinds of rights does an unprivileged enemy belligerent have?
Not very many.
What does unprivileged mean?
Okay, well, that's a good question. Unprivileged means that they're not prisoners of war. They don't have the status under the Geneva Conventions of prisoners of war. That means that they're not soldiers in uniform. These are people that basically we call terrorists, right, or insurgents. This is what we mean when we say we're fighting terrorists. These are people who are shooting and they're not wearing a formal uniform. So the result is we've called those unprivileged belligerents, and that means we don't treat them as prisoners of war and we don't give them the same rights. So they don't have, and under the United States military's position, they don't really have any rights at all other than the most basic minimum right, which is to humane treatment. and that's under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention that applies to everyone. But the U.S. has taken the position that international human rights law does not apply to these people.
But this is the sort of thing that had people up in arms during the Bush administration, and we were debating all of those Geneva Convention rules. How come we're not hearing about it now?
You know, it's a great question. I think maybe the American public just sort of came to accept it. Unfortunately, the whole paradigm of the war on terror has not changed very much under the Obama administration. So I think that there was a lot of hope that when President Obama came in, he would change things, and he issued the order that you mentioned to close Guantanamo Bay. And none of that happened, and we've kind of given him a pass on it. So I think, you know, he has improved the treatment of prisoners. We don't believe that people are being tortured now, at least as far as we know. So the kind of early days of really terrible abuse at Bagram that we heard about, where people were being killed in prison, we don't believe that's happening now. But there are still people who are detained for 8 years or more without charge, without trial, without the right to see a lawyer, without the right to even see the evidence against them.
Eight years or more. Now, in Guantanamo, there have been people there who have been in prison since they were 15 years old. Are we seeing similar things in Bagram?
Again, we don't know, because we don't know. We don't have the same information about the prisoners at Bagram. So we know that they're all men. I mean, there's been no indication that there are any women there, but there are probably some teenagers there. There's certainly some teenagers there. But again, we just don't know. We don't have any information. The only people who have access to the prison outside of the U.S. military are the ICRC, the International Red Cross, but they operate confidentially, so they're not allowed to publicly report what they're seeing.
My guest is Daphne Evyatar, a senior associate at Human Rights First. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So does that mean you haven't been able to visit Bagram?
I was able to visit Bagram, but I was only able to see the hearings that the U.S. military was giving to the prisoners. I was not able to privately interview any of the prisoners while they were in prison. I was able to interview detainees, prisoners who had been released within the last year, so people who had been held by the U.S. government and released during the Obama administration.
And what
I was able to talk to them.
And what did they tell you about their experiences?
Well, you know, there was a range. I think most of them, many of them had been picked up in night raids, which I mentioned earlier, kind of when the U.S. forces will go with Afghan troops and they'll go and they'll raid a compound and they'll gather all the men out and you question a lot of them and bring some of them to the prison. We talked to them about kind of every stage of the process. So I think the two key things that I mentioned in the report, one is that they're first initially brought to a classified facility, which has come to be called the Black Jail, because there are no windows and so no one knows what time of day it is in there. And no one has access. No one outside the military, again, has access to this facility. It's classified. We don't know what the conditions are like other than what the detainees describe. And so there the conditions are, from what we understand, very minimum, very basic. Lights on 24 hours a day. Their sleep is interrupted. They're often in question in the middle of the night. There seem to be tactics of sleep deprivation being used. You know, no mattress to sleep on, that kind of thing. After the first couple of weeks, they're transferred to what's called the Parwan facility now, and that's a new prison that was built late during the Bush administration, and that's a much nicer facility. So the treatment in that sense, once they're transferred to the main facility, is better. It's more kind of consistent with humane standards. The problem, though, that we were really focusing on is the fact that even once they're in this better facility, they're not being abused or mistreated there, but they still don't know why they're in prison, many of them. So they have a right to a hearing every 6 months now, but they go in front of this board of U.S. officers, and they'll make a statement, and they'll say, you know, I was arrested, I don't know why I was arrested, and then there'll be a U.S. officer who will summarize the charges against them, but they don't actually provide any evidence against them. And the prisoner has no right to access that evidence. So, you know, the charge might be you're an IED facilitator or an assistant to the Taliban, and that's all the evidence they get.
And they don't have an attorney.
And they don't have an attorney. That's the other thing. So, again, unlike in Guantanamo, where most detainees now are represented by attorneys, in Bagram, they're not. They're not even allowed to speak to an attorney. So they have something called a personal representative, which the military assigns to them, which is a junior officer who's supposed to help them in their presentation. But in the cases that I saw, it was really not much of a help at all. I mean, the personal representative would say almost nothing, or they might ask a question that would seem completely irrelevant. You know, instead of asking, you know, demanding that the U.S. produce evidence of why they've held this person or why they think this person is Taliban, the person, the representative would ask the detainee, well, how have you been treated here? And what will you tell the other villagers if you return to your village? What will you tell them about U.S. forces?
Are witnesses ever called?
You know, we were told that they are called sometimes, but in none of the hearings that we saw, there were none called in the 7 hearings that we observed. So, and another colleague of mine had observed another 4 hearings earlier, and there were no witnesses in that one either. So what seems to happen is after someone's been there over a year, eventually they might be able to tell the personal representative, look, try to find somebody from my village, a family member, or the village elder to come in and testify on my behalf. And so that seems to be the kind of witnesses that sometimes do come. And usually it takes a long time before the personal representative gets around to finding that witness to come and basically be a character witness and say, yeah, this is a good guy. One problem we heard about, though, is that sometimes someone will come in from the village elder will come in and testify, this is a reliable person, he's not Taliban, and actually the detainee will say later he's never seen that person in his life.
A listener wants clarification of whether the Geneva Conventions do or do not apply to Afghan and Iraqi detainees.
They do, but in sort of a minimal way. Only Common Article 3, which ensures humane treatment, applies directly. And the reason is because in this kind of a conflict, where it's what's known as a non-international armed conflict, so we're at war with insurgent groups rather than with another country, the issue of detention is not directly addressed in the Geneva Conventions in that kind of a war. So what we've been arguing and what most international legal experts think and European commissions have ruled on in other kinds of cases is that the international human rights law then would apply. So, and the international human rights law requires that you have a right to an impartial hearing, to legal representation, to certain minimum fair processes. And in this case, they're not getting them. And the U.S. says, well, we don't believe that the international human rights law applies to our actions abroad.
What about the 3 Supreme Court rulings which limited the Bush administration's assertions about Guantanamo detainees? Did they apply at Bagram?
You know, unfortunately, we don't know yet. And the reason is that the Supreme Court was very careful to say that it was ruling only on the situation of Guantanamo detainees. You know, and in some ways you can say, well, it's almost the same situation, right? It's a U.S. military base in a foreign country being used as a prison and holding people during this war on terror. Unfortunately, the lower courts, there have been a couple of cases brought on behalf of Bagram detainees saying that they deserve the same right to legal representation and to bring their case to court. And the lower courts have said, well, this is in a theater of war, and so it's different. And basically, they kind of made the argument that it's just impractical to provide lawyers or to give actual judicial review to people in the theater of war. But what I thought was very interesting in researching this report was that if you look at comparable situations elsewhere in the world, Israel, for example, which has obviously a big terrorism problem and captures people all the time in their wars, they provide lawyers and judicial review to people that they capture as suspected terrorists. And I thought that was very interesting that Israel is willing to do that, which is often criticized for its human rights record, and the United States is not.
Who's running Bagram? Is this the Pentagon, the CIA, some other organization?
It's the Pentagon. It's a DOD military establishment.
What percentage of the people who go through the hearings we've been talking about end up being released?
You know, we don't know the exact percentage. I can say that in 2010, for example, they arrested maybe between 1,300 and 1,400 people, or that was the number of people that were brought into the prison, and they released about 500. But we don't know, you know, when the ones who were released were captured or exactly what the turnover is.
But your report also suggests that some of the prisoners who are recommended for release are still being detained indefinitely.
Yeah. Now, that's the other big problem, is that you have a board of three officers that will hear these hearings every 6 months, and they make a recommendation as to whether or not the person should be released. In some cases, well, that recommendation has to be basically approved by a higher-level military officer or commander. In some cases, the commander has not approved the release, but there's no reason given why they have not approved the release after this board of officers has heard all the testimony, seen the evidence. I mean, there is evidence in these cases. I should clarify that. It's just that it's classified. So the detainee isn't allowed to see it. I wasn't allowed to see it. No observers who are not cleared for classified information are allowed to see it. Only the military sees it.
So if you're not guilty, you still may never be released.
Right. And the other problem is if you're Pakistani or you're from another country, there's a significant group of those people who have been cleared for release and are still not released. And again, there's been no reason given why they're not being released.
Now, last night, the president said, I'm quoting, "We will not try to make Afghanistan a perfect place. We will not patrol its mountains indefinitely. That is the responsibility of the Afghan government." So what does the drawdown mean for the prison population at Bagram?
It's a really good question. I mean, obviously, the fewer U.S. troops that are there, chances are the fewer detainees the United States is going to be bringing in. However, they have already, the number is growing so quickly already at Bagram. I mean, now it's over 2,000, and the facility was built to hold 1,100. So they know they have a problem. The U.S. military knows that this is a problem. They're holding too many detainees. They want to transfer them to the Afghan government. The problem is the Afghan government doesn't really have the capacity to handle them. And what I mean by that is they don't really have a very well-functioning justice system or a reliable justice system. It's, as you know, I'm sure, a very corrupt government, and most people view the justice system as being extremely corrupt. People buy their way out of prison rather than get out because they're innocent or have served their time. So the problem is that the U.S. needs to really invest in developing the justice system there so that it can just at least offer some semblance of due process to people, and it can take over handling detainees and providing them trials.
And sometimes prisoners don't even have to buy themselves out. Last April, nearly 500 Taliban insurgents escaped through a tunnel in a Kandahar prison, which would raise some serious questions about whether the Afghan government would be able to handle national security prisoners of this sort.
Right, absolutely. Actually, I mean, there's obviously a lack of oversight if they're able to dig a tunnel out of their cell and out to freedom. So, yeah, there's serious problems there. I mean, on the bright side, there are some efforts to train Afghan judges, Afghan lawyers, to create a defense bar, because there really are very few defense lawyers in the country. That's a very new concept for them. But that is starting to happen, and the more that happens, the more that can become a check on corruption. The more training there is, the more that judges are appointed based on their training and knowledge and not on political connections, the more you're likely to have a reliable justice system. So even as we withdraw troops, I think it's really important that the civilian assistance under the State Department continue and really invest in long-term development of the justice system, because you cannot have a stable society without a reliable justice system.
A listener wrote this on our show page. "I just read an article in The Nation about military investigators who failed to adequately look into hundreds of cases of abuse and torture in Iraq, in the U.S. bases and jails. Is the same sort of thing happening in Afghanistan?"
It's funny. That was written by a friend of mine, Josh Phillips, and it's a great piece, and it really is a very interesting point. That has happened in Afghanistan as well, that cases where people have been killed in prison, tortured, are kind of shoddily investigated. I'm actually working on, with Human Rights First, working on a separate report looking back at all of the deaths that occurred in U.S. custody since the beginning of this war to see what happened, were they investigated, and who was held responsible. But so far, of all of the cases that we're aware of where a detainee died in custody, no military personnel has been convicted or sentenced to more than 5 months in prison. And that's people who were beaten to death in custody.
Daphne Evyatar is Senior Associate at Human Rights First. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for your interest.